Actually, they started doing this series Rav Desper has about different agadatas and or different agadic issues and have their explanation. And it goes in order of the Torah, of the Chumash itself, but you know, obviously skips a lot in between. Each thing talks about the one we did last week. We did the first one, the first couple, and we did the last one we did, it was about Yiridas Avraham and Mitzrayim, the one on the right. So there he had, we spoke about this issue about whether one could critique the Avos, when Chazal do not critique them, can one, which the Ramban did. The Ramban says that it was actually the sin of Avraham Avinu going down to Mitzrayim when he was not supposed to, which caused the Golus for Klal Yisrael. In other words, when they went down to Mitzrayim later on, that was because Hashem was punishing them for Avraham Avinu's going, leaving Eretz Yisrael on his own initiative. So we said that there is a Zohar which does say that, but were not to be a Zohar, it would be very difficult to accept, you know, such critique on the part of the Ramban without having a source in Chazal. This is a major issue in contemporary Orthodox Judaism, in the sense that there are many people who feel that it is proper, good, and humanizing to criticize the Avos, meaning that, or any other great historical figure, because that way, if you humanize them, so then they're more relevant to your lives. But then, what the result of that is that they're very often things which people say which are absurd, such as, you know, Yitzchak and Rivka had a dysfunctional marriage because they didn't have to relate to Esav and Yaakov, and therefore, since that is the case, one of my Sheva Brachas, one of the speakers said, it was Parshas Chayesor, or whatever it was at the time, told us, which has Yitzchak and Rivka and Yaakov and Esav, and he said, he gave us a bracha that we should not build a house like Yitzchak and Rivka's. Because right. Wow. Yitzchak Rivka's household was so dysfunctional that obviously we don't want to emulate that. Now, there are great rabbis who do that. The Rav Shamsi Falhush does critique Yitzchak and Rivka's relationship, and he says that it was not proper, not the optimum, and therefore there were all the problems with the kids. But even Rav Shamsi Falhush, I don't know what right he had to say it. I think in the Tzibo also might critique Yitzchak and Rivka for their relationship, but in general it's a very, very difficult thing to say. Very difficult to do things like that because you don't really know. The same way you really can't psychoanalyze Mozart or Napoleon properly because they're not alive to interview them. So certainly how much more so, the more you go back in history, the less capable you are of psychoanalyzing somebody and figuring out what exactly was going through his mind or what kind of issues he had, positive, negative. And in general, it's been accepted throughout Klal Yisrael's history that the people mentioned, sort of the Avos, Moshe Rabbeinu, were, you know, much higher spiritually than people who came after them. So therefore, we generally don't critique the Avos. We, meaning people who I admire, generally don't critique the Avos unless there is a source for that in Chazal for such critique.
What about them critiquing, taking, Muhammad and Yoshua? We can't say anything about them either.
Right, we can't say anything about their psychology. One could say, you know, the Rambam writes that Muhammad was a meshuga, which means crazy, but what I think he means, the usage of the term, is that he claimed to have visions. And if your visions are not true visions, then they are crazy visions. So I think that was why he called him Amshuga.
But one day he called him Amishtagia.
Yeah, same idea. Yeah.
Like, sort of, maybe more make himself.
Could be, yeah, but he made himself that way. That might be. So, but yeah, you're right. We should there's one Akron, I don't never see this inside where he does this, but Rabbi Yaakov Antin, who says that Jesus was a good guy. It was just, you know, misinterpreted by his followers.
What?
Rabbi Yaakov Antin. Rabbi Yaakov Antin was one of the big Chanoim, one of the tremendously zealous people But he had kind words for Yashka. So it's interesting.
About what?
Huh?
About what?
Shabtai Tzvi.
Yeah. How about with Gemara, though? I mean, because there's a sense of critiquing psychology in the Gemara that goes on, or is it different?
In the Gemara, they critique each other.
Right, but even you could say, you could look at an opinion in the Gemara and say, this. How can he dare say this?
I can do that?
Well, you can in the Gemara itself, you can find a Mora critique another. How dare you say that?
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, well, I was asking on two levels. I mean, on that level, yes, everything that comes after in the Gemara, and even if you pick up a Gemara and you feel that if you're a Talmud Chacham and you look at the Gemara and you're saying, how can he say this here? I really don't understand this, or something doesn't add up in one place. Isn't that a sense? Isn't there, how does the line come down in Gemara, you know, with that respect to that?
So it's interesting, I'm going to digress a bit before I answer your question, okay? The digression is, I just got an email today. I got actually a couple last week. I didn't open it up yet. But somebody sent me today a passage from it. And it is a eulogy written by a professor, Mark Shapiro, in Stratton University, about Professor Mordechai Breuer, who just passed away last week or a couple weeks ago. And in this excerpt, it talks about some minor Achron, one of the minor luminaries, who said that there's certain things in the Gemara which clearly were interpolated, put into the Gemara, by later sources who wanted to make a mockery of Talmudic logic. One of them is a famous case in our current Daf Yomi Masechta, where there's a case discussed in the current Daf Yomi Masechta of a guy who fell off the top of his roof and fell into a woman who was his sister-in-law, who had been married to his brother, the brother had died without any children. So the question is, if he just fell off and into her, in an intimate way, of course, whether that would be considered to be sufficient to create the state of Yibum, which is required in order to, you know, fulfill the mitzvah. Now, so they... So the Gemara says, conclusion, they don't need Kavana. So that's the issue, whether you need kavanah or not. So this guy Shapiro was quoting a guy called. It's one of the most funny cases in the Yevamos. When I left Chicago, so it was around this Bubba Comets. One of the mementos they gave me when I left, which I no longer have, is a tzedakah pushka with a little naked doll about to fall off the roof. So, just to commemorate that.
Wow.
That
the
question is, when the Jews were more humoristic in times of Gemara or now?
Right. So, point is like this. This leads to a very major issue, whether you can just claim that something like that was put in later, and there is a certain school of thought nowadays which is gathering steam in the left-wing Orthodox community, that you could do that. You could say, well, this part was put in later on, and it really is not part of the original Talmud, and certainly it shouldn't be considered authoritative. But that, which, of course, is extremely, it's not just dangerous, it's wrong, because that means anything you don't like, you reject. You say, well, this is put in later, or this section of the Gemara was, you know, was something which is not authoritative because of XYZ factor. So that's a very dangerous approach. Now, why am I bringing that up? Because the Gemara was an intellect. The Gemara took place in an extremely intellectual environment. And extremely intellectual is the reason why some of the scriptures of the Gemara are strange, are weird, are totally impractical, and why you have Tanoim and Amoraim critiquing each other, taunting each other, insulting each other. Why is that? Because that is the flavor, that's the atmosphere in a Beis Medrash. In Beis Medrash, it's not when you go in and there's interaction, people are not necessarily polite, right? That's not the way it works. People start shouting at each other, people start calling each other names, not major names, but they call the name of the, you idiot, don't you know Pshat is like this? The other guy says, no, stupid head, Pshat is like that, right? and things like that can go on. Now, the Gemara says that the Esvahay Besufa is it's expounding on a pasuk in Balak and says that there has to come Vahav, which Gemara says Ahava Besufa. The Gemara learns like that Besufa at its end. In other words, as long as the Talmudic argument is conducted the right way, even if it becomes very intense, it leads in the end to love between the two people. Because there's a sense of affection of having gone through something together. But in the process, you need to do certain things. And one of those things is to come up with these weird cases. Because they're funny, they're strange, they bring out a point, and they make that intellectual activity more exciting, more, that's what I'm looking for, more engaging.
You may want to set a precedent also.
Yeah, that could be too, but some of them are actually precedent-setting ways, which I don't even know if Chazal thought about it. Like this case in Bechulin, where it speaks about when you transplant a fetus from the womb of one animal to the womb of another animal, who's the mother? So that only became relevant in any way, shape, or form when the issue of surrogate motherhood came up several years ago, where they implant a fetus in a mother other than its own. So then that's when that Gemara actually became a relevant Gemara. For thousands of years it wasn't. So the thing is like this, that last week, when we finished on Monday, I finished teaching MTA. And we had a seal. And one of the guys came over to me afterwards. It's not, I had a shiur which had the top guys, the bottom guys, and the large middle section. Right? So one of the middle guys came with me and said, "Rabbi, you succeeded in doing something." I'm very proud of this. I'm patting myself on the back right now. Okay, you ready? "Rabbi, you succeeded in doing something I thought would not be possible until I went to Israel, which is you got me excited about learning." So how do I get them excited about learning? What do you do? Precisely with a lot of these acrobatics, which make it exciting. And sometimes, as you know, I use my wit to the extent that I possess it, my humor, and sometimes, you know, I taunt them. It does work that way. That's how very often a shiur works. So, and it works effectively. So that's all part of the Talmud, and that's why in the Talmud you have critiques. Okay? In Talmud you have critiques and insults and negative statements, which took place in the context of the intellectual pursuit. I'm not sure I answered your question.
So you're making that distinction between something that encourages and stimulates the intellect and stimulates learning, and you may use a sort of criticism in there compared to someone who goes after Avraham Avinu and starts attacking him. So that's why it is kosher to do it in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
But the statement you made about the guy falling off the roof, an example like that, it seems that Chazal is trying to illustrate a greater point, that obviously that case is, you know, far-fetched. How do you know? I mean, doesn't that open up a whole other dimension of how do you start to understand the statement like that? In terms of, is it just
from whose perspective?
From the
mine or theirs?
From the perspective of me or you, your perspective.
We understand that this is a case which is not going to happen because I don't like talking about it.
They like talking. So from their perspective, they put that in because they wanted to try to teach a lesson. That
I'm not even sure that's the case. I think it's a record of conversation, which might not be.
It's a record of conversation that went on.
Yeah.
The reason I'm bringing it up is because I'm trying to understand, you know, there's a whole, I guess, from my understanding, but there's maybe within that school of thought that's emerging within the left-wing orthodoxy, like, there's a critique of the science of Chazal. Is that a whole different thing?
It's a different ballgame. Science of Chazal is a different ballgame. I'm not sure, me personally, I don't see what's wrong with critiquing Chazal and their science.
You don't think, so what is that whole debate? Because I thought that was maybe connected a little.
There are some people on the extreme right who think that Chazal, not so extreme right, who think Chazal, whenever Chazal said something scientific, it clearly was either true or had some esoteric meaning which we can't understand anyway.
Oh,
what is the extreme way?
What?
So what's the difference? You say it's not extreme. What is the extreme?
The extreme right?
Yeah.
This is the extreme right position, but people who are not in the extreme right take this position a lot too. Mm-hmm. Okay? That is Art Scroll's position. That any Quran which you have, which you can't understand because it's it has these strange chemical concoctions in it or physics issues. So anyone who understands, it's really very, very profound, a secret, and it's just something which you can't understand because it's beyond you. The extreme left and those over there say, well, Chazal didn't know what they're talking about. Chazal were a bunch of stumblers like the rest of us, and they stumbled. And sometimes they got it, sometimes they didn't. They weren't so bright. So, you can't really trust them on any science, and especially on halacha, which emerges from that science. The vast middle ground.
So how do they explain the validity of halacha?
What?
How do they explain?
They have in their minds, it makes sense to them on some warped, crazy level, to say that halacha is different than agada, and therefore, halacha is binding on us, agada is not binding on us.
Make sense?
What?
Make sense?
No.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Why not? Because halacha is halacha. You have all.
What is history? Is history halacha or agada?
What is what?
History.
History? Agada, I think.
So then, how do we know anything is true?
By agada.
But you just said agada is. We just said, according to these people, agada is not binding because it's not necessarily accurate. So your whole basis of Judaism is undermined, right?
But on the other hand, you can go, you try to make arguments, very strict arguments, that try to... He told me about it, that you had a book about the arguments that you have the history, and the history must be valid, because otherwise... So if you try to make, like, arguments beyond the historical events, then maybe it's somehow in a higher level terms.
Yeah, but that's not so simple, because a lot of what we do is rooted in history that we assume that Torah is given Mount Sinai. You take that away, this whole religion falls apart.
Right.
Right. That stinks.
So I say
that Chazal knew of that which they were talking, up to and including all contemporary medicine. And perhaps they knew more. But they knew all contemporary medicine, they were up on the journals, but they didn't necessarily know more than what was going on at the time. So therefore, if you have a question like, does the sun go around the earth or the earth go around the sun? You know this big question, whether the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun?
I once heard a guy say, I don't know, actually, I'll let you finish and I'll say what I think.
Lubavitcher Rebbe said the sun goes around the earth. He explained based on Einstein's theory of relativity. He said, really, there is no, I mean, it's really semantics. There is no
point.
No, there's no point of center, right?
You have,
in
Einstein's
theory, you have points of reference.
What?
You have points of reference. There is no absolute moon. You have points of reference. So, perhaps the Rabbi Rebbe said that if you choose it as your point of reference to Earth,
right,
then it's on you.
That's basically what he's saying, yes.
He says that the geocenter, he says everything moves around the Earth, or what? What does the Gemara say on it? What does the Jewish stance on it?
I don't know if the Gemara takes a specific stance. But what I wanted to say about...
Where's my train of thought?
The Baal Shem Rebbe and the...
Before him.
Science.
Thank you. So if the sun goes around the earth, earth goes around the sun, there's no need for us to assume that Chazal knew exactly what was going on. Makes no difference. No matter, so therefore, why not accept? So in fact, we find that one of them says that first the rabbis thought the sun goes around the earth. Then they heard the Greeks hold the opposite, and they said, well, the Greeks are probably right. But the reason they gave was not a good reason. The reason they gave is because in the morning when you get up, then the springs are hot. So if springs are hot, it must be because the heat came from the bottom of the world, right?
I think the Greeks actually said that the heavenly bodies revolve around the earth.
What?
The Greeks, I believe, came up with that.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, I made a mistake.
It wasn't Galileo.
Yeah, you're right. The Greeks said it was around, but Chazal say, I
think,
Chazal says that it goes back around the dome at night. My question whether the sun goes like this, or the sun goes like this.
Well, what about the other half of the year?
What?
According to Chazal, what about the other half of the year?
It's always dark. Okay, so that's how they proved it wasn't the. They proved the sun goes around the earth from the, by the fact that we have springs, so the springs are warm in the morning. So it must be that the sun goes under the earth and heats them up at night. So, you know, to us it seems absurd, but that was the standard of science at the time.
For Chazal.
What?
Chazal says, this is what Chazal says in the war.
Yeah.
But the...
Wait, so one second. On the other hand, saying like history, right? There's, you know, I'm sure many of you have heard the 165-year gap. Who hasn't heard the 165-year gap?
What?
There's 165 years discrepancy between Jewish history and secular history. They hold the base, the first base of Mikdash was destroyed 165 years earlier than we did do, and 166, and the second, the second base of Mikdash, of course, rebuilt 165 years before. So they have the dates of 586 BCE and 516 BCE. According to us, that's off. It should be actually 420 BCE and 350 BCE. So the question is how to deal with that discrepancy. So the way most people, the way Rabbi Schwab dealt with that discrepancy, we haven't spoken about this recently?
I haven't heard.
Who's heard this from me?
Not from me.
No one. So the way Rabbi Schwab, the father of our Rabbi Schwab, dealt with it, in my opinion, is horrendous. It's terrible, it's dangerous, it's impossible to accept. He said that Chazal, can I make myself clear on that? He said that Chazal made a great cover-up. They covered up 165 years of Jewish history. Why they cover it up? We don't know. The cover-up was so successful that we don't know what they were covering up.
I heard it's because of Mashiach. If Mashiach doesn't come at the year 6000, they push it ahead in 165 years or something.
What means he has come earlier?
They covered up. What does that mean?
You know what cover up is? Like the Watergate, you know, where Nixon erased 18.5 minutes of the tape?
They covered up. How can you cover up 165 years? What does that mean?
They took them and eliminated them from the calendar. They pretend that they never happened.
Doesn't
we don't know!
Doesn't Ari Kaplan hold by this?
No.
He holds by something like this, though.
No, I don't think so.
But, so what do you say to this?
So I think, why do I say this is dangerous? Well, not just dangerous, it's obviously wrong. Because if Chazal made that up, why couldn't they make anything up? In other words, who says anything they say? They were so successful covering up. Maybe they were covering up that Jesus was the Messiah.
I don't trust anything anymore. I'm going out there. It's all over.
No, but how can you prove that you
can? What do you mean?
You cannot prove that Jesus was the Messiah because he died.
Look, there's actually things in your mind like that.
Maybe they made up that he died. Maybe he didn't die. Maybe he went up to heaven.
Maybe he became Oprah.
You say he opens up so many gates, if you say so.
Yes, and all, it undermines our whole... If Chazal were not accurate in history, then I think it undermines the whole basis of our religion. So other people obviously disagree with me, but I can't understand their perspective.
So, what would Rabbi Schwab say about it?
What?
What would Rabbi Schwab?
Schwab
say about your argument?
We haven't heard it yet.
I don't know. He's dead. But he did officially retract his theory, but I heard unofficially he still retained it even after he retracted it.
Why did he retract
it? I think because of objections like this. So
what are some other options besides this?
Also, what other options are there? So the starting point of this issue is the assumption that the Tanakh and Chazal were all wrong about the length of the Persian Empire. a Persian Empire didn't just last 34 years like we have it, but it lasted 200 years, which is the discrepancy of 166.
Mm. But say science is wrong.
What?
Why is that? We say science is wrong. They measure from archaeology.
Not science, history.
But they're documenting through, how did they
that's the point. In other words, the way historians, they don't go into ancient, Persia, they don't go into ancient Shushan and find a document which says, this bill of sale written 386 BCE. And then another document says, this document written 254 BCE, right? And another document, this was the year 2 BCE. They didn't keep dates that way back then. They didn't know that they were counting down. They thought they were counting up. And therefore, they had a totally different system. Moreover, most kingdoms had a system which was based on the years of the king, not based on the years since creation, right? Moreover, we're going back archaeologically and trying to figure out what happened. We're not actually, don't actually have them coming and telling us anything about their lineage. So therefore, and the most important point in my opinion is that all secular history, almost with very little exception, relies on one guy. Everybody know who that one guy is?
Yeah, Josephus.
Levitus. Yeah, he's...
Homer.
Herodotus.
Excellent.
Quickly.
Herodotus the Greek. Herodotus went and collected stories from all the from countries he traveled since. He collected stories and made a history of the world out of it. So there's this one guy, Herodotus, against Chazal. But if you have a real apologist, they'll start from the assumption that Herodotus was right and Chazal were wrong. And that's what an academic would do, in my opinion, it's certainly not warranted.
Saying Chazal was wrong on this could create a lot of problems with the whole Jewish calendar in many ways, with even Chagim and everything, no?
In theory, it could. But you have to say that since they still had the authority to tamper with the calendar back then, so they tampered with it as necessary.
And you think a rabbi could be put in harem for saying that Chazal was wrong on this point? Which is a big
well, I don't know. I don't think anybody would put Rabbi Schwab in harem.
He didn't say
Chazal
was wrong.
He said they're coming up.
He didn't say they were wrong.
Yeah. No, you can't put Rabbi in harem. I don't think. Well, I don't like being put. I'm a very tolerant, liberal kind of guy. You want me to start telling you who you can put in harem? Can't put in harem.
Where's my pen?
So you put it on Herodotus, then that's what you say. So you just switch
it.
Here's the difference: is because Chazal may have it wrong. You say no. Let's question Herodotus.
Right.
And just flip it right back on them.
Right.
And they can't say anything.
So what they say is, what they'll tell you is, see, we've all been poisoned. All of us have been poisoned. Because the way we learn most of what we know is through school textbooks. And school textbooks, or television, of course. School textbooks are present things as fact, which are actually conjecture, and not necessarily agreed upon by all scholars. Now, it's true about history. It's certainly true about science. And I think that which did religion the most damage in history was that artist's depiction, this guy must be roasting over a fire in hell somewhere, the guy who made this artist's depiction of the progression of the evolution from amoeba to man. Everybody knows the picture, right? You know, it goes up, 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 and the monkeys at the end finally get man.
It's like in Pepsi ads, you know? Did you see it?
I didn't see it.
They go this way, and afterwards you see them...
No, it's only from a monkey.
Again, backward in the computer.
Not from the monkey to man?
Goes all the way. Goes from amoeba to man.
I come from an amoeba?
Yeah. Life would be much easier if you stayed in amoeba.
Single cell organism.
So the thing is that that you see that picture in your high school textbook and you think, oh, for sure, this is what happened. Look, there's even a picture of it. So that causes a lot of harm, a lot of damage, and it's not warranted. So therefore, what they'll say is, well, all the books say this. And then they'll say, well, documents have revealed this. And then they'll say, well, you know, there are engravings in Shushan and other places which reveal this. With very rare, extremely rare exception, none of them who make these statements have actually read the documents. They just assume they're there. None of them actually gone to Shushan and read the inscriptions. They just assume they're there because other people have told them to.
Right.
So when you get down to it, the evidence itself is very iffy. Herodotus and saying. In fact, there's several indications that it's based on faulty interpretation. There was this crazy genius about 50, 60 years ago, Emmanuel Velikovsky wrote many books, nutty books, fascinating books, and I forget which one this was, whether it was Worlds in Collision or the Sea Peoples. He basically, even though he was Jewish, but he didn't believe in God or anything like that, he basically takes, without knowing it, Chazal's chronology. Because he says what happened was the Egyptologists got two papyri, right, which they thought were about two different periods, 165 whatever years apart, and they actually from the same period. And then that was how they made a mistake, because they it put in that whole thing in the middle.
So how does Chazal think? Do we assume all these things are like from Matan Torah, or they're
history?
History and science.
No, we trust them on history.
Because of Rav Kodesh.
No!
Because they were in it.
Yes!
They just heard it.
But they were so, I mean, 1,000 years, they were removed.
What 1,000 years?
From whenever the Gemara was codified.
But they had an unbroken train of transmission.
And Herodotus is putting pieces together, broken pieces.
And besides, the Greek tradition broke.
Not in terms of science, it's from observation.
It's from observation.
So you really...
By the way, there's a very important Beckhoffer corollary to that. There's a very, very important... This the Beckhoffer theory, okay? When we say Chazal determines science from how they observe things, even if they made mistakes, they're right.
In what respect?
What?
In what respect?
In respect that halacha follows Chazal whether they're right or wrong. In other words, when you get, let's say, you kill the louse, and Chazal on Shabbos, Chazal said you're allowed to kill lice because they reproduce asexually. Right? So, let's say they're wrong. So it comes up to heaven after 120 years, and you say, God asks you, why did you kill so many lice on the Sabbath? You're dead. Well, actually, he's dead anyway. But you're in hell. So you say back to him, no, God, because I followed the halacha. So God will say to you, of course, God will say this, the basic shaman will say to you, the heavenly court will say, well, didn't you know that science proved that halacha wrong? So God will say, or rather, you'll say, that halacha is still in the books.
So we're not concerned about accurate perceptions of science because I only talk about them in terms of Torah ideas. Chazal's science, like they're right like in the moral sense, the Torah sense, but they're inaccurate in terms of just simple observation science. The Torah, the Chazal and stuff, we don't say that, I don't know all the science talk about, but they only talk about science in terms that it might have Torah application.
There are some Gemaras which just go on for pages giving, you know, remedies for all sorts of sicknesses. But something, you know, something like this about whether lice reproduce sexually or asexually is actually part of a halachic process, whether you're allowed to enjoy it.
Look, in Bechoras they're talking about certain things animals mate, and these three animals are the ones that talk to Hashem, so I look each other in the face. Like, I don't know what Torah we draw from that, but if it's inaccurate...
Wait, say that again?
Like, in Bechoras they talk about how animals mate in one section. There's some part where Rashi talks about the mermaid and certain things, the dolphins of the sea. Like, are there any implication on the halachas or anything we draw from that? Or why do they tell us that? Just for us to.
The Talmud is not just halacha.
But that's not a gadata either. They're not stories.
Okay, there is scientific knowledge. I told you there's scientific knowledge. So that would be part of scientific knowledge.
So what do I do with it? It's inaccurate. So I don't have to draw Torah from it. We just dismiss it. We just read this. Because I'll. Like if I want to know about science, I'm not going to read Chazal's science. If I want to know about Torah, I'll read their...
Yes, but there, even with their Torah and science clashes, what wins at the end of the day is Torah. You know, it's like let's say you are in Arizona. I've never been to Arizona. What's the speed limit in Arizona?
Depends where you are. In, on surface streets or?
Highest speed on highways.
Uh-huh, 75.
75. So let's say in Arizona, the speed limit is 75. Okay? What?
How much is it here?
50.
Between 50 to 65. And the East Coast is almost always 65 tops. Mm. The Midwest, it gets up to 70. In the West, it gets up to 75. Mm-hmm. So, but this is all relatively recent. 15 years ago, there was a federally mandated speed limit of 55 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. So let's say you go to Arizona. There's not a car around for miles on this highway. And 10 years from now, they actually made it 75 miles per hour by now, by our time. But back then, you no car anywhere in sight. You go 75 miles per hour, you're going to get a ticket. If the cop catches you. Why? Because the law is on the books until somebody overrides the law, until somebody who's allowed to override the law. The same thing is true in the opposite direction. In other words, let's say that there is a loophole in the law. So then, for example, let's say it was permitted for people to get their money out of the hands of the IRS by putting it in private Swiss bank accounts. There is no such rule, but let's say there was, right? So of course you're shirking your responsibility as a loyal, upstanding citizen to pay taxes. But you know they made the rule. You don't have to give up your advantage. So that is the same thing in terms of the vice or whatever scientific issues Chazal say. It's not, they came up with leniency, I'm entitled to use that leniency until such time as somebody else comes and says leniency is not applicable or...
But if I want to read about the mating habits of a certain animal, do I go to the Bukhara's Ahmed phony or do I go to science books?
Even Rob, when Rob wanted to learn how to find, you know, how to define the movement, the blemishes, which rendered the Bechor unfit, he went to live for 18 months among the shepherds. It's a famous joke, I shouldn't say famous. There's a joke that I know, which is probably not famous at all, about...
famous, not famous at all.
The scientific method. Sir Francis Bacon, I guess, is an English physicist, one of the originators of scientific method in the 1600s. So he has a story in which there was a tremendous argument between two groups of people in a tavern, in a bar. One group of people said a horse has 24 teeth. The other group said a horse has 28 teeth. And there was a pitch battle.
I know this joke.
Back and forth.
See, it's famous.
So finally, somebody suggests, well, you know, let's go look in the mouth of the horse and count how many teeth he has. So they both look at him, both sides, and say, you want us to go look in the mouth of a horse? And they continue arguing. Right. So that... Then
there are them,
Cash, I'm not... Don't take the number specific. Thank you. So
fewer. You want to argue?
Yeah, right. So that type of approach is one which would, you know, say that, well, it doesn't matter how many horse the teeth are. How many teeth the horse actually has? That is what my position is and why I take that position.
It sounds like the history of philosophy. Ethics. There's a poor man banging outside your house. I'm not going to talk to that filthy pig. Ethics.
Can you
add
it one more time?
I took a class, his philosophy of racism, and he pointed out he showed half of the philosophers wrote things on ethics and human law. Is that they had share trades and slaves and the pigs.
Yeah. So the,
I
have a question right then.
Yeah.
What's the case in the Gemara about an elephant jumping?
So this is a Slifkin case. The Slifkin said, I don't know how many of you in this room are familiar with the Slifkin issue.
Can you get into that a little bit? Like,
I thought we discussed this.
I'm in fact.
Only me and you discussed this?
What is Zifkin?
I don't know.
So just knock and I discussed it. Okay, if that's the case, we're going to do it again. We discussed it in my house, we discussed it in the Shiva. So there's a fellow in Israel whose name is Rabbi Nassim Slifkin, or Natan Slifkin, depending on your perspective. And he wrote a series of books about Chazal and science, particularly about Chazal and their perception of the animal kingdom. And he got in big trouble. And his books got from the Cherem, and therefore they're selling much more than ever before. So the you want a book to sell, you gotta put in the Cherem, otherwise nothing happens. So the so he was put in Cherem because in these books he takes the position that very often that Chazal were wrong. Not that you know, and that we now know better, and therefore things should be changed, both in the curriculum and maybe even in law. The case of the elephant was a case where there's some tesis, it's not even Chazal, it's a tesis, which says that you ask the question, how do you acquire an elephant? I want to buy an elephant for you. How do I do it? Paying money doesn't make a kinyan on movable objects in halacha, right? So, and I can't pull an elephant.
You have to hold it.
Why? Well, I'm holding it's not a kinyan. So how do I get, so what kinyan is left? Hakbah, picking it up. How do you pick up an elephant? So the place it says, you get him to jump on top of a box. Right? So there's somebody who's supposed to have framed Slifkin and ask him a question. What do you say about this Tosfos who says that an elephant can jump? It's like white men can't jump. So elephants really can't jump, right? So the Slifkin said, okay, it's wrong. They made a mistake. So because he held that elephants can't jump. So that got him the hot water. It was one of the later reasons I got hot water, because he said he just assumed that Tosfos is wrong. You don't just assume that. I mean, you can say that, and maybe Tosfos was wrong. But he just took it as the a priori. The initial assumption is Tosfos is wrong, it really is something else. Now, also with that in the hot water, I am...
So science say that elephants can jump.
Right, elephants can jump. Now, I am not pleased, but I was gratified in a certain sick sense. I saw my Talmidim in MCA, one of the key traits necessary to be a good Rebbe is to have a sadistic streak.
Okay.
You have to take pleasure in tormenting people, right? Otherwise, can't really be a good Rebbe. If you just want to be, you know, just want to be lovey-dovey with them, so it's not going to work. You have to be able to enjoy, get a sadistic pleasure. They like that a lot. Anyway, so I took sadistic pleasure in that I was partially responsible for getting Slifkin in trouble. Because I had an email exchange with him in a public forum, which surfaced, which said that Slifkin basically, and this is why I don't like his perspective, he holds that the flood never took place. Why do we, how does he know the flood never took place? Because nobody's ever found evidence that the flood took place. They took core samplings of rock going down thousands and thousands of years. Nobody's found any trace of the flood. So if it says the flood didn't happen, and all of Sefer Bereishis until the end of Parshas Noach is basically a metaphor. Now, two ways to say a metaphor. One is that there was no Noach, there was no Mabul. All this is a question of how good and evil clash with each other. The other perspective is to say there was a guy named Noach. He sat in his bathtub for a long time. He took boats and poured the water in, pretended that he had a flood, and his little toy boat continued to flow. But
don't mock that.
So it was his rubber ducky. So and then he told the whole story about that.
When you have showers.
What?
When you have showers.
Yeah. So the that approach is, in my opinion, extremely wrong. First of all, if we start saying things that Tanakh never took place, so maybe Yitzias Mitzrayim never took place, maybe Mount Tor never took place. But more than that, I don't know, more than that, but more than that, his reliance on science. What?
In addition.
His reliance on science is absurd. Because the fact it's almost impossible to reveal in sedimentary rock what happened over the course of a year. You know, you measure things in the course of decades, centuries, epochs. But he wants to find a trace in a core sample of something which happened over the course of 1 year.
And you told him this, and what did he say?
What?
You wrote this to him?
Yeah.
And what did he say back?
Nevertheless.
You never got a response?
No, I said that he said nevertheless.
Oh, nevertheless?
Yeah.
Can you say it one more time with the rock?
Sorry. The main proof he has that the flood never took place, that they do in certain places all over the world, I guess random places, they drill down deep with a hollow drill. And they pick up the stick, which is formed in the middle, whatever it's called, and that stick is called a core sample, because it's the core of the drill, and it samples all the layers of rock and sediment going all the way down to bed, to whatever they get to.
Okay.
That's far down. They never got to rock bottom, but to wherever it gets to. And then they look at bands in the sediment and see how climate changes affected the Earth. Right, because you can see trends, but those trends, every inch is like a 1,000 years. So therefore, to find one specific year, that inch, and expect to find it, is absurd.
I've heard that the evangelists they open up a little museum to try to imitate the.
Yeah. So the. So in terms of Sliskin, I think that this second thing is much more dangerous. That to allegorize Chazal or the Chumash itself, and purely on the basis of your assumption that your arrogant confidence in your scientific evidence. It's a big deal. I really lost my train of thought. Who asked about Sliskin? You asked about Sliskin?
I asked about the elephant.
Oh, the elephant. So the elephant is Sliskin. Right. So he's the one. Yeah.
A lot of articles I read, it's always reconciliation about the age of the universe. 14 billion. Nobody talks about it by the age of civilization or the age of man. Even if it was 14 billion, even if you say, well, 60 is 14 million years old, you still have to come back and say that Adam was the first man, that there weren't civilizations before, like Native Americans and Indian, all these things.
No, but there were previous cycles.
Right, so the bones and things you find were of previous cycles. But there weren't. But there was not a continual cycle.
There's an opinion in Judaism that there are cycles of existence on this globe, on this earth before us.
There's not a continuation of civilization.
Right, and then they're destroyed, and we create it again. So if you find, Neanderthal man, could be that's from previous cycle.
Maybe they had the civilization.
Right.
Yeah, could be that that's a pretty high level civilization, but it doesn't seem that way. Yeah, what?
Isn't that
anyone in the Gemara? Yes, it's only, it's a hint that the Gemara was showing.
In the Kumash, yeah.
Yeah.
I know in anthropology there's two theories on how humanity spread throughout the globe. There's, I think it's one, the trellis theory, and I can't remember the other one. Basically, they say one, humanity originated in like five different places throughout the earth, and one says in one place throughout the earth.
So our perspective is that whatever happened in previous cycles, in this cycle is one person, one place.
So it's the one theory is in alignment with the way where it came from one place.
Yeah, listen, I think we're going to have to stop here tonight since I'm falling asleep, and I'm sure you'll notice that. But I want to ask you to help me decide something. Rabbi Braun called me today and asked me to give this Shabbos and for a series of Shabbosos after this class in Jewish history.
Very nice.
So
when and where?
This week the slot is 8:45 to 9:25 p.m.
Every Shabbos?
After Shabbos Shuras.
Every regular Shabbos or just each?
In and regular. Not out.
That'd be good because there's not the sushis take way too long.
So that
the sushis?
After. 8:45 to 9:25.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
Okay, now the question is, what period of Jewish history you want? You guys get to choose.